This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Hwang Jong-yup is in Washington today to tell the Bush administration and Congress what he knows about the brutal policies of the government in North Korea and why he thinks the United States should not negotiate with Kim Jong-il. Hwang was a high-ranking official in North Korea before he defected 6 years ago. Today, we're going to find out who he is and how his story may affect the administration's hopes to resume six-party negotiations that are aimed at convincing North Korea to abandon its nuclear weapons program. Later in the show, we'll talk about the solar storm that hit the Earth today and about fighting fires in the suburbs of Southern California. But first, North Korea. In a few minutes, we'll talk with two members of Congress, one who expected to be in North Korea this week until the Bush administration told him to cancel the trip, and one who expects to meet Mr. Hwang during his visit to Washington. If you have questions about this man, about the credibility of the image we get of North Korea from defectors, or about how to resolve the dilemma of North Korea's bomb, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from our bureau in New York is Peter Moss, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He interviewed Hwang Jong-yup last month for his profile of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il, and that story appeared in the October 19th issue of the magazine. And Peter Moss, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Good to be with you.
Who is Mr. Hwang?
He's the highest level defector ever from North Korea, and really as high of a level defector as one could possibly imagine from any state. He was pretty much the ideological chief of North Korea, kind of the Karl Rove of North Korea, if you like, and therefore was the top aide, top advisor to Kim Il-sung, who was the founder of North Korea, and then also to Kim Jong-il, who, of course, is the current leader of North Korea and the son of Kim Il-sung.
Now, you mentioned he was sort of the ideologist. He was responsible, I guess, for the idea called a Juche, which I guess is sort of a Stalinist autarky, but can you describe it a little bit?
Sure. Juche, which kind of generally is translated most often as self-reliance, is an ideology that pretty much Hwang Jong-up came up with, and this was kind of promoted as the national ideology in North Korea. And, you know, if to get down to its basics, basically it kind of means that North Korea should be politically, economically, and militarily self-sufficient. It shouldn't have to rely on outside states for its survival, and it should chart its own path.
And this has been, I think it's safe to say, an economic disaster.
Yeah, well, Juche exists as an ideology only in name now, and in actual practice, economically, North Korea is a total basket case. It depends virtually entirely on fuel and food shipments from the outside world, particularly China, but also other countries as well. Politically, it, of course, is on its own, but it really has very little power beyond, of course, the weapons of mass destruction that it might possess. And then militarily, this perhaps is the only area in which Juche is somewhat alive in the sense of North Korea does, of course, have a million-man army. It has ballistic missiles, may have weapons of mass destruction. It can't, of course, defeat countries such as the United States or China that might wish to invade, but it does indeed have quite a military force.
Now, Mr. Hwang, as you said, was a member of the elite of the elite, a very high-ranking member of the government. Why did he defect 6 years ago?
He wrote a memoir which explained all this, and it's really quite a fascinating memoir. It hasn't been translated into English, or it hasn't been published in English, but there is kind of an unofficial translation circulating around in intelligence and government circles, which I was able to get. And basically, he is a true ideologue. I mean, he hasn't had a change of heart in terms of becoming a Democrat or becoming a capitalist. He feels very much that Kim Il-sung kind of was led away from the original goals of North Korean socialism to construct a communist state that's independent, etc., and that instead North Korea developed into a cult of personality, and that Kim Jong-il was largely responsible for this, advising his father and eliminating people who perhaps wanted North Korea to be a bit more democratic in its socialism. But very much Hwang Jong-up still kind of has these true communist ideals, and it was because of what he saw as the kind of deviancy of the North Korean regime that he decided to defect, to tell the truth about it.
Now, the South Koreans have kept him under pretty tight wraps all this time. Why did they do that, and why are they allowing him out to visit Washington at this fairly delicate moment?
Well, this is one of the strange things that's going on or has been going on for the last few years in South Korea. Under former President Kim Dae-jung, South Korea altered its policy towards North Korea away from hostility and towards engagement. And it didn't want to really do anything or say anything that would upset North Korea. Of course, in 2000, Kim Dae-jung went to Pyongyang himself for the first ever summit. Now, when Hwang Jong-up defected to South Korea, this was in a way kind of a hot potato for Kim Dae-jung because Hwang Jong-up wanted to do nothing but talk about North Korea and criticize North Korea and criticize particularly the South Korean government policy. So they kept him, the South Korean government, bottled up, and they wouldn't let him speak out very much, if at all. They certainly wouldn't let him travel. But in the last, 6 months, under a new president whose policy is not quite as forthright in terms of being friendly towards North Korea, they're giving Hwang Jong-up a little more leeway to speak out on his own.
Well, given that isolation, I guess when they decided to loosen up, that's how you got an interview with him?
Yeah, it was not easy to get because I had been working on this story for a while, and I had been approaching people around Hwang Jong-up, writing them letters, calling them, emailing them, trying to get them to agree to let me talk with him, and including also people in the South Korean government, because they ultimately control him. They have security agents around him. He used to be under virtual house arrest. In the end, I had the intervention of a South Korean journalist, a conservative journalist who knew Hwang personally and who spoke up for me and who was able in the end to arrange for me to go see him at this place that I'm actually can't say where it was.
But I assume obviously the government knew about it. Was there a government minder there?
There wasn't a government minder in the room where I spoke with him, but there were armed security agents outside of his office. You had to walk through a metal detector. They took everything out of your pockets and out of your briefcase, and they waved one of those metal wands around you. But I think everybody assumes that his office is bugged. I mean, it would be inconceivable that it would be otherwise. South Korea has a very powerful, security service, and it would just be inconceivable that they wouldn't bug his office.
Now, he has said, and I should remind our listeners, the United States is involved in six-party talks with North Korea that are aimed at getting North Korea to abandon its nuclear weapons program. In return, North Korea's asked for a non-aggression treaty with the United States for diplomatic recognition, for foreign aid, and for help with its power production. This defector, Mr. Hwang, has said he doesn't think the United States should be negotiating with North Korea. Why?
Because he thinks that it will just strengthen Kim Jong-il's regime. The history and, Hwang Jong-up was in North Korea during, decades of engagement that North Korea had with not just the United States, but particularly also China and Russia. The history of foreign engagement with North Korea is that it has always helped the regime. And Hwang Jong-up very strongly believes that the sorts of aid packages that would be linked to weapons control agreements with North Korea would provide Kim Jong-il with the resources he needs, with the money he needs, with the food he needs, and with the oil he needs in order to retain the loyalty and to pay off, in a sense, the military and the political elites, and that the people would continue to suffer.
So this would prop up the regime, in other words.
Exactly. And this is kind of a conundrum that is faced not just in North Korea, but with dictatorial regimes all across the world. Basically, if you choose to engage with them and you have these grand ideas about programs or foreign aid that you want to give them, it has to be funneled through the central government. And the central government, particularly the one in North Korea, does what it wants with it. And because the North Korean government really doesn't have any money and resources and needs it desperately, it needs particularly to use whatever it gets to shore itself up and also to increase its prestige with the domestic population so that people think, the rest of the world is dealing with our leader, so, we can't really do anything against him because he's the man the rest of the world wants to be in power with and negotiate with.
President Bush has famously been quoted as saying that he loathed Kim Jong-il. And, of course, the joker in the deck is nuclear weapons. We may not want to engage this man or send anything that might prop up his regime. On the other hand, you don't necessarily want him to have nuclear weapons either.
Well, he may already have nuclear weapons. The CIA has publicly estimated that North Korea probably has one atom bomb, if not two, and that now, as a result of it, North Korea, taking control of these plutonium rods that used to be under UN control, it has the material for perhaps, 10 or 20 more nuclear weapons. So the genie may already be out of the bottle, as it were, with North Korea. And in some ways, the debate, instead of being one of trying to prevent North Korea from getting the bomb, might be, you know, what to do with North Korea now that it has the bomb.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's get a call in from Jeff, who's in Wilmington, Delaware.
Hello, great show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Why don't we listen to Mr. Wan? My question originally was, why does the world and the United States in general negotiate with these dictatorial regimes? They're inhumane, they're irresponsible, and yet we continually negotiate with them, and ultimately it comes back to haunt us. Why do we do that?
And I assume you're referring, you know, in part at least, I guess, to past negotiations with people like Saddam Hussein.
That's right. When we gave weaponry to Saddam Hussein to actually fight his enemies, and now he turns it, and then he turns it against us.
Okay, Jeff.
I mean, have we not learned our lesson?
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you,
Peter Moss.
Well, I think that there are kind of two reasons that this goes on. One is that, you know, in general, diplomats prefer the status quo, and they're always or tend to be afraid of kind of shaking things up because you never know what might happen, and that. It counts not just for the way things were with Saddam Hussein, but also, for example, with Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, who for a long time, actually, the United States did not oppose in any direct way. With North Korea, there's the added kind of complication of the fact that, well, if we don't give him what he wants, then he's going to make a lot of trouble. He could export his know-how. He could export more missiles. He could perhaps even try to export the bomb. So in this case, there's a lot of mischief that some people in the administration and outside of the administration fear that he can do if we ignore him, if we don't give him what he wants.
One of the problems with defectors is the fear that when they come across to the other side, they are just telling their new friends what they think they want to hear. Is the picture that we've developed about North Korea, there have been so many more defectors in the past few years, people who have arrived, are we getting a pretty coherent picture at this point?
Well, I think we are, but I think, you know, you're very right that you have to be cautious of this. Of course, you know, now famously, the Bush administration was led astray or let itself be led astray by defectors that were from Iraq who were kind of promoted by the Iraqi National Congress. That's Ahmad Chalbi's operation. Mm-hmm. So we always have to be very cautious about what any defector says and never kind of take it on face value or take it without confirmation. But the key thing with Hwang is that there have been, as you mentioned, in the last couple of years particularly, a lot of defectors, not all just kind of ordinary North Koreans, but also people who were close to the regime or in the regime, I mean, including even a bodyguard for Kim Jong-il. And there also, most crucially, have been members of Kim Jong-il's own family who have defected, who have talked about it, who have written about it. There was, for example, a sister-in-law of his and a niece and a nephew who left North Korea, who defected. And these people all describe very similar pictures of the regime, of Kim Jong-il's control of it, and how he controls it. So what Hwang Jong-op says, if that's all we had to go on, you'd have to be extremely, extremely skeptical of it. But because it is backed up by so many other independent testimonies, it has very much the ring of truth.
And a lot of that testimony describes terrible conditions, not only the starvation of the people, but the terrible conditions in camps where political prisoners are held, sometimes for months, years, beaten, and sometimes killed. This is going to be a problem for the Bush administration as these negotiations continue, is it not?
Well, only if it chooses to not ignore it. One of the things that the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before it did was pretty much ignore the human rights aspect of this problem. You know, North Korea really is pretty much hands down the worst place on earth in terms of human rights abuses now. They have prison camps, they have executions, and if you ignore it, it's not a problem. But if you try to do something about it, then it becomes a problem because the regime resists any suggestions for change.
We're talking about the situation in North Korea and the effect of defector Hwang Jong-yup, and we're taking your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking about the challenges facing crews fighting the California wildfires. If you're interested in that subject, you can call now, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send email to us at TOTN at NPR.org. Again, that's 800-989-8255. At the moment, we're discussing the high-level official who defected from North Korea several years ago, who's in Washington this week to meet with administration officials and members of Congress. In a few moments, we're going to be joined by one member of Congress who's going to be at one of those meetings tomorrow. At the moment, we're speaking with journalist Peter Maas, who interviewed Hwang Jong-yup last month in Seoul, South Korea. That's before his visit to Washington. And let's get another caller in. On the line with us now is Ruben, who's in South Boston, Virginia.
Yes, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
The thing that I want to get back to is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And I feel like China and Russia, having supplied North Korea, and China, of course, stood up and stopped this at the 38th parallel, have a lot more to do with this than just dealing with a very crazy dictator. And I feel like this really gets back to the point that, you know, we cannot supply countries like Afghanistan in the 80s or Saddam Hussein when he was fighting Iran, and nor can we allow other larger states here in the post-Cold War era to support people as the North Koreans have become basically, I think, a proxy for these larger governments.
Well, Peter Maas, you wrote in your article that Kim Jong-il, and I guess I'm paraphrasing, but maybe crazy like a fox. In any case, what about Ruben's question? What about the influence of China and Russia, formerly the Soviet Union? And is North Korea in any way a proxy for them?
Well, I think Ruben's very much right about the 800-pound gorilla. I think not quite right to call North Korea a proxy for China, because actually the Chinese are very upset with Kim Jong-il, and they really don't like him very much, and they certainly don't want to see nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula and right next door to their own border. But the fact is that China does supply food and fuel to North Korea that really keeps the country running to the extent that it's running. And as well, China has a very long border with North Korea, and it has kept it pretty close. People do sneak across, but if China wanted to destabilize Kim Jong-il's regime, really all it would have to do is open the border, and presumably a lot of North Koreans would flee, and that would destabilize the regime. So in a way, more than what the U.S. can do, the important question is what can or what will China do, and also what will the U.S. do to put pressure on China if the U.S. really wants to try to deal with changing the regime in Pyongyang.
And Ruben, I guess to make your point, Wu Bangguo, who's a number two man in China, is in Pyongyang in North Korea meeting with the officials there even as we speak. Thanks very much for the call, Ruben.
Thank you.
All right. Let's get another caller on the line. Albert is with us from Rochester, New York.
How are you doing today?
Okay.
You know, the thing is, I'm hearing, you know, this defector, I can't really pronounce his name, but was saying don't negotiate, don't give him anything to help the government, you know, help perpetuate Kim Jong-il's rule.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if he gets desperate enough to start selling his weapons of mass destruction on the clandestine market? I always thought that North Korea was a much larger threat than Iraq ever was. But the only reason why we didn't do anything is because Seoul is within artillery range.
Right. I guess Peter Maas, Albert is outlining the Faustian bargain there.
Yeah, well, that is the main concern of the U.S. administration. It's this question of proliferation of nuclear weapons, proliferation of missiles. I think, you know, one of the things that you have to keep in mind is that it's possible for containment to work. It doesn't always work, but to a degree it worked with Iraq. I mean, the country, as far as we know now, did not currently have any weapons of mass destruction, and certainly the UN inspections regime had a big role to do with that. Of course, North Korea has kicked out its nuclear inspectors, but there's very few borders that North Korea has with other countries, and you could, with the cooperation of China and Russia and surveillance of the waters around North Korea, perhaps do a pretty good job of containing the proliferation threat.
Unless they put it on a submarine, because there's no SOSIS net around Korea. I was thinking more about their the chemical weapons, because they have a very large stockpile, and right now that's basically a better and more deniable terrorist weapon than an atomic bomb. It's kind of hard to do plausible deniability on a nuclear weapon, but it would be on chemical weapons.
Albert, that's a good point. Thanks very much. We're going to go now to Capitol Hill, and with us on the line is a member of Congress who will be meeting this week with Mr. Hwang, Congressman Christopher Cox, a Republican of California, who was instrumental, in fact, in arranging Mr. Hwang's visit to Washington. And, Congressman, thanks for being with us today.
I'm happy to join you.
I understand you had dinner with Mr. Hwang last night.
I did, and it was the culmination, as you suggested, of literally years of effort. We had in Congress invited Hwang Jong-yup to come and meet with us some years back. We've been working diligently on that invitation, and finally the South Korean government permitted him to come and meet with us in Congress as the highest ever defector and someone very close to Kim Jong-il and his father. Hwang Jong-yup has a lot to tell us.
When you finally got to meet him in person, were you there to listen, or were you there? What questions did you have for him?
Indeed, I was there to listen, and of course, as always, there's never enough time. We had a few hours. We'll get a chance further this week to learn more from him. He is speaking with people in the executive branch. I know who's at the State Department getting debriefed today. But one of the things that I was most interested to talk to him about was the approach that the United States and the rest of the world should take in order to achieve what everyone hopes can happen in North Korea, and that is freedom and an end to this misery that is producing so many refugees and so much hardship. And it was very clear in his mind that means the elimination of the Kim Jong-il regime.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem. Well, at the same time, they have nuclear weapons and all those artillery tubes pointed at Seoul, South Korea.
His analysis, and of course we're going to get more of it, but his analysis seems to be that it is vitally important that we separate North Korea from their only source of outside support, which is the People's Republic of China. That China needs to understand that North Korea is always already acting against the PRC's interests, and that if the PRC can be encouraged to take that course, and if there could be a separation of North Korea and the PRC, then he believes that the regime will fall internally, and that acting, he said, even dictators need some friends. And acting alone, he does not believe Kim Jong-il would start a war.
PRC, of course, People's Republic of China. Are his admonitions and his descriptions of the nature of this regime and the brutalities it's visited upon its own people, is that injection of this moral element going to make it more difficult for the administration if it wants to go ahead and negotiate a deal?
Well, I think that what the administration wants, what the South Korean government wants, what Hwang wants, ultimately is all the same thing. The question is how best to achieve it. So it isn't so much a difficulty that is introduced. It's a different understanding of what's going to work. I think all around the religion is pragmatism. People understand that they can't have a foreordained approach when they're dealing with ultimately one man who controls so much in North Korea.
Now, this is his advice and his counsel. Is that going to make you more cautious about the negotiations that are underway?
I think we're going to learn from what Mr. Hwang has to tell us, and that our discussions with North Korea, and of course these are multilateral discussions, will be better informed as a result. He's trying to help us understand that the regime of Kim Jong-il is thoroughly based on the leader's personality cult, that our fundamental attitude towards that regime has to start from the standpoint that democracy can't compromise with this sort of dictatorship.
And are you going to follow that advice? Do you think the Bush administration should? There should be no compromise and no deal.
No deal, I think, means recognizing that certain kinds of deals are going to lead nowhere. We have now, in addition to Mr. Hwang's information, we have the experience, our own experience of the last near decade, during which we proceeded on the basis of good faith with the government in Pyongyang. The United States taxpayers sent over $1 billion in aid during the Clinton years. We went from zero foreign aid with North Korea to making them the number one recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the Asia-Pacific region. And in return, they made promises in writing about what they were going to do. Last October, they publicly announced to the world that they had deliberately broken those promises. I think you have to learn from that experience.
Can you take a call with us, Congressman?
Sure.
Let's go to Craig, and Craig joins us on the line from Asheboro, North Carolina.
Yes. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm about ready to go to work, so I'm going to have to ask and then go.
Okay.
But Mr. Wong suggest not to negotiate with
North Korea,
with dictators, then what is the solution? For example, we've had Fidel Castro in our rear end for years.
Mm-hmm.
We've not negotiated with him. We just dealt with sanctions. But yet he is still there. So the question is, what is the solution?
Thanks very much for the question, Craig, and have a good day at work.
Thank you.
Okay. Congressman Cox?
I think it is a vast oversimplification of what Mr. Huang is trying to tell us to infer that we should not talk to the North, that we should not try to have influence there, that we should not proceed, for example, as we are proceeding with these multilateral discussions. I do believe that what he is telling us is that we should not, as a result of those contacts, prop up the regime of Kim Jong-il. That should not be our goal. Economic aid for North Korea, which is something that we have tried and it didn't work, as I mentioned, over the last several years as a means of changing the government, is not as preferable as, for example, increasing contacts with the North, because what we're after is the democratization of North Korea. In Huang's words, the most reliable way to demolish the North Korean dictatorship is to awaken the people, who may then apply grassroots pressure to their rulers. That means that we've got to use every means at our disposal to get more influence inside the North. We're providing, we have been providing for many years, a food aid, but we haven't been providing any monitoring to make sure that that food is going to the starving people of North Korea instead of being used as a means of control by the government. And not only Mr. Huang, but other high-level defectors from the North have told us that is how the food is being used. It's being used to prefer Communist Party members. It's being used to feed Kim Jong-il's million-man army. Insisting that if we're providing this kind of humanitarian aid, that non-governmental organizations, that trusted third parties, if not the United States government, go in and follow that food aid to its intended recipients is a means of opening up that country that can introduce the rest of the world. We've got to take every opportunity that we can to find little cracks and open them up and let some sunshine in, to use the South's term.
Congressman Cox, thanks very much for being with us today.
Of course.
Christopher Cox, a Republican from California, speaking with us from his office on Capitol Hill. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is a congressman who was supposed to be in North Korea this week. His trip, though, was canceled at the last minute. Congressman Kurt Weldon, a Republican from Pennsylvania, is on the phone with us from Capitol Hill. And, Congressman, it's good of you to join us.
I'm happy to be here, Neil. And the trip's not canceled. It's postponed. I'm determined we will go back in, and we're currently in discussions with the White House and also with the North Koreans. We will not back down from our effort.
Well, as you might infer from what Congressman Weldon just had to say, he was there in North Korea, I think it was last spring. Why did the White House ask you to postpone the trip at this particular moment?
I know, I can't figure that out. We are totally unequivocally supportive of the president's posture. On our last trip, we reinforced the need for the six-nation talks. In fact, we stressed that to both the foreign minister, vice foreign minister, speaker of the Supreme People's Assembly, and to the business leaders that we met in Seoul, particularly Chairman Chung of Hyundai Asan Corporation, who had visited with Kim Jong-il personally five times. So there was no distance between our position, and there is no distance between our position and the president's position, Democrats and Republicans. I think it's within the administration. There are battles back and forth between state and the NSC and others, and it really offends me that we got caught up in this. because our efforts, I feel, and the North Koreans will tell you, if you ask them, as I have frequently, that our efforts were very positive. They did not try to use the delegation to try to say it was something that it wasn't. In fact, in every statement that came out, they were very factual in their analysis of why we were there. So, and we also have the legitimate role as Congress people to do fact-finding missions. And I don't know of any administration that's ever stopped anyone, unless we were at war with the country, from visiting. And the irony of this week is that while we were being undermined by White House operatives to remove our plane, the Chinese Communist Supreme People's Assembly sent 24 members of their Congress into Pyongyang for discussions. If that's not irony, I don't know what else is.
Now, as I understand it, you had hoped to meet with Kim Jong-il yourself on this visit and also visit the nuclear processing plant at Yongbyon.
Absolutely. In fact, they had committed to me when I was there, when our delegation was there in late May, early June. They said, Congressman, we want you to come back. I had the interpreter for the president with us from the State Department, Tong Kim, and he had been in North Korea 16 times, and he made the observation after our first day there that he had never seen the North Koreans that he had met with so many times as when he interpreted for Madeleine Albright, Bill Perry, and Secretary Kelly. He had never seen them so animated, so positive, so constructive as they were during our trip. So I really think we reached a new level of engagement with them, not as negotiators or diplomats, but simply to show them the face of America and our people. And they said, we want you to come back. I said, I will come back, but we won't come back unless and until you would agree to the six-nation talks. And it was in August that those six-nation talks were held in Beijing. I called the Ambassador Han, up at the DPRK mission in New York in September, and they invited us back in, and the dates were supposedly this week. But, you know, we're determined in this effort. This is not an attempt to undermine the president. It's not an attempt to, you know, put Congress into a role of diplomacy. It is a legitimate role of the Congress, and we think we've been extremely constructive and helpful. And for the White House to pull the plug on the airplane, for some reason they have not yet identified, is beyond me. And as a Republican supporter of the president who supports his policy 100%, I'm very troubled.
Congressman Weldon, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Congressman Kurt Weldon, Republican from Pennsylvania, speaking with us from Capitol Hill. And Peter Moss, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Peter Moss's article was The Last Emperor, published in the New York Times Magazine, October 19th. 2003. When we come back from a short break, we're going to be talking about solar flares and also about the difficulties of fighting the fires in Southern California, not just in forests, but sometimes in suburban subdivisions. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.